A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's essentially two questions folded together. First, how do different countries actually formulate and communicate national threat levels to civilians? And second, how do you strike that balance between giving people actionable signals without becoming the boy who cried wolf? He's coming at this from the Israeli experience, where over the past year there have been two full-scale wars, and at least three shorter rocket salvos. Government messaging has been contradictory, and there's this weird tension where normal life keeps insisting on itself right up until you're scrambling for the go bag. So we're looking at comparative systems. What's out there? What works? What doesn't?
This is one of those topics where most people only encounter these systems as a color on the evening news and never think about what's underneath. But the design choices are fascinating. You're essentially trying to compress an entire intelligence assessment into something a civilian can glance at and act on.
Right. Compress an intelligence assessment, but also not give away what you actually know, which is where it gets interesting.
Let's start with the American system, because it's the one that's been through the most public iterations and rebrandings. After 9/11, the US rolled out the Homeland Security Advisory System, and everyone remembers the colors. Green, blue, yellow, orange, red. Five levels, from low to severe.
The rainbow of anxiety.
And it was almost immediately a problem. The system launched in March 2002, and by 2004, it was being widely mocked. There was a Saturday Night Live sketch. There were editorial cartoons. The whole thing became a cultural punchline. The core issue was that it almost never dropped below yellow, which was elevated, and it would spike to orange, high, with no specific guidance attached.
The signal collapsed into noise.
When you're always at elevated, elevated means nothing. And the alerts were almost never accompanied by concrete instructions. What does that mean? It was the security equivalent of a parent saying, "Be careful as you walk out the door."
Which is functionally useless, but makes the parent feel better. And I think that's the trap these systems fall into. They become a way for the government to say, "We warned you," rather than a way for citizens to actually modify behavior.
That's precisely the critique that eventually led to its replacement. In 2011, the Department of Homeland Security scrapped the color system entirely and replaced it with the National Terrorism Advisory System, or NTAS. And the key difference is that NTAS only issues alerts when there's something specific and credible. No permanent background hum of yellow. Either there's an alert or there isn't.
Binary is better than a gradient nobody trusts.
The alerts themselves are structured. They come in two flavors, elevated threat alerts and imminent threat alerts. Each one includes a summary of the threat, what geographic area it applies to, what the public should do, and how long the alert stays in effect. Crucially, they have expiration dates. An NTAS alert auto-expires unless it's renewed, which forces the agencies to actively reassess rather than letting something linger indefinitely.
That expiration date is doing a lot of work. It means the default state is no alert, and if you want to maintain one, you have to justify it again. That inverts the incentive.
Under the old system, lowering the threat level felt like taking a risk. What if something happened the day after you dropped to blue? Under NTAS, raising the threat level requires ongoing justification. It's a much healthier default.
What's the track record been? How many NTAS alerts have actually been issued?
Relatively few, and that's kind of the point. The system has been used sparingly, mostly around specific events or credible intelligence about particular targets. After the January 6th Capitol breach, there was a supplemental NTAS bulletin about domestic violent extremism. There were alerts around the Afghanistan withdrawal, but it's not a constant presence in American life the way the color system was.
Which I suspect means when one does go out, people actually pay attention.
The counter-argument is that the NTAS has the opposite problem. It's so quiet most of the time that when an alert does appear, the public infrastructure for receiving and acting on it has atrophied. Nobody's checking the DHS website daily.
Let's move to Israel. since that's the lived experience behind the prompt. What's the home front command system look like?
Israel has something fundamentally different in structure, and it's worth understanding why. The Israeli system isn't a single national threat barometer. It's a set of geographically specific, event-driven alert protocols managed by the Home Front Command, or Pikud Haaref. And the reason it's different is that Israel faces a different threat profile. The U.S. system is designed around terrorism, low-probability, high-consequence events. Israel's system is designed around the reality of rocket and missile attacks, which are recurrent, geographically targeted, and require immediate action.
It's less be vigilant, and more you have 90 seconds to get to a shelter.
The Home Front Command divides the country into alert zones, and the instructions vary by zone and by the expected flight time of the munition. If you're in Sderot, near Gaza, you might have 15 seconds from siren to impact. In Tel Aviv, it's more like 90 seconds. In Haifa, facing the northern threat, it might be different again. The instructions are hyperlocal and hyperspecific.
Which is the opposite of a national color code. It's granular to the point of your building versus the building next door.
It has to be, because the action is different. In some zones, the instruction is to go to a reinforced room or a public shelter. In others, you lie flat on the ground and cover your head. In still others, you shelter in place. The system is built around a specific behavior, not a general posture.
That's the acute attack warning. What about the broader threat level? Is there an Israeli equivalent of the situation is deteriorating, adjust your readiness?
This is where it gets murkier, and I think this is what the prompt is really driving at. Israel doesn't have a formalized, public-facing tiered alert system for the general security situation. What it has is a mix of official home front command guidelines, like keeping a certain amount of water and canned goods, having a sealed room prepared, knowing your nearest shelter, and then a much more informal ambient awareness that's communicated through media, through WhatsApp groups, through the fact that everyone knows someone in the military.
The signal is cultural rather than institutional.
Yes, and that has advantages and disadvantages. The advantage is that a culturally embedded threat awareness doesn't suffer from the boy who cried wolf problem in the same way. It's not a switch being flipped on and off by an authority, so there's no authority to lose trust in. The disadvantage is that it's uneven. New immigrants, people outside the main social networks, tourists, they don't have access to the ambient signal.
The ambient signal can be wrong. Group psychology isn't exactly a calibrated instrument.
No, it's not. And we've seen this play out repeatedly. In the lead-up to the Iranian attack in April 2024, there was a period of about 48 hours where the Israeli public knew something was coming. It was in the international media, flights were being canceled, the IDF spokesman was giving carefully worded statements, but there was no formal civilian alert level change. People were left to triangulate from partial information.
Which is almost worse than an official alert, because you've got all the anxiety but none of the clarity about what to actually do.
That's the balancing act the prompt is describing. If the government says heightened alert, what does the civilian do differently? If the answer is nothing specific, then the alert is just anxiety production. But if there are concrete steps that should be taken, and the government doesn't communicate them, that's a failure too.
Let's look at some other models. What have other countries done that's structurally different?
The UK has an interesting system. It's a 5-level threat classification managed by the Joint Terrorism Analysis Center, or JTAC. The levels are low, moderate, substantial, severe, and critical. But here's the key difference from the old American color system. The UK levels are primarily an internal tool for security services and law enforcement. They're made public, but they're not really designed as a civilian action trigger.
They're telling the police what posture to take, not telling me whether to cancel my theater tickets.
The levels determine things like how many armed officers are deployed, what kind of surveillance is active, whether certain venues get additional security. The civilian is downstream of that. You might notice more police presence, but you're not being asked to do anything specific yourself. The exception is critical, which means an attack is expected imminently, and at that level there is some public communication about what to expect.
Has it ever hit critical?
A few times. After the Manchester Arena bombing in 2017, it was raised to critical for several days, also after the Parsons Green 2 bombing attempt, and the interesting thing is that when it hits critical, the public communication shifts. Suddenly, there are military personnel visible at key sites under Operation Temperor, and that visible change itself becomes a signal.
The signal is, you're seeing soldiers at the train station, which means you should understand the situation is extremely serious. The communication is almost environmental.
And that's a design feature, not a bug. It communicates threat level without requiring the public to check a website or watch a press conference. You see it, you feel it, you calibrate.
France has something similar, don't they? The Vigipirate system?
Yes, and Vigipirate is worth dwelling on because it's been through several iterations and they've learned some hard lessons. The current version, introduced in 2016, has just three levels: vigilance, enhanced security and risk of attack, and attack emergency. Three levels, clearly named, each with associated visible measures.
Three levels is elegant. You can hold three things in your head.
They're tied to concrete, visible actions. At the vigilance level, you see the standard security patrols. At enhanced security, you see armed military patrols in public spaces, the famous Operation Sentinel soldiers. At attack emergency, you see a much heavier deployment, and certain public spaces may be restricted or closed. The French have basically accepted that the public won't remember a color code or check an app, but they will notice soldiers with assault rifles outside the supermarket.
Which is its own kind of communication. The medium is the message. Literally, the presence of armed personnel is the alert.
It's a communication that can't easily be ignored or dismissed. A push notification you can swipe away. A soldier at the entrance to the metro is harder to tune out.
There's a cost to that, isn't there? Living in a visibly militarized environment changes the texture of daily life. It normalizes something that maybe shouldn't feel normal.
And that's one of the critiques of Vigipirate. After the 2015 attacks, the Sentinel deployment became semi-permanent, and there's a real question about whether the public just stops seeing the soldiers. They become background furniture, at which point you're paying the cost of militarized public space without getting the communication benefit.
The glockenspiel of national security. It's supposed to signal something, but after a while, it's just part of the ambient noise.
That's exactly the dynamic. And it connects back to the Israeli experience. When air raid sirens become a regular occurrence, the startle response attenuates. You still go to the shelter, because the consequence of not going is catastrophic, but the psychological impact changes. It becomes routine.
Which is both a coping mechanism and a vulnerability. You cope, but you also stop being as vigilant as maybe you should be.
Let me bring in a few more comparative examples, because there are some genuinely different approaches out there. Sweden issued a civil defense booklet called If Crisis or War Comes to Every Household in 2018, and they updated it again in 2024. It's a physical booklet mailed to every address. And it's fascinating because it's not an alert system, it's a preloaded set of instructions for a range of scenarios.
Instead of telling people the threat level in real time, they're saying, here's what to do if things go wrong. Keep this somewhere you can find it.
The booklet covers everything from power outages to nuclear attack. It tells you how much water to store, what food to keep, how to stay warm without electricity, where shelters are located. It's essentially a go-bag checklist distributed at national scale. The communication is, we're not going to tell you day-to-day how worried to be, but we want you to have the baseline knowledge so that if something happens, you're not starting from zero.
That's actually quite a humble approach. The government is admitting it can't predict the threat with enough precision to issue useful real-time guidance, so it's offloading the preparedness to the individual.
It's consistent with Swedish civil defense culture, which has deep roots going back to the Cold War. Sweden maintained a posture of armed neutrality for decades, and that meant a population that was expected to be self-sufficient in a crisis. The booklet is a continuation of that tradition.
What about the Asian models? Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, they all face concrete, recurrent threats.
Japan has J-Alert, which is primarily a broadcast system. It pushes alerts to mobile phones, interrupts television and radio, and activates outdoor loudspeakers. It's used for earthquakes and tsunamis, as well as military threats, so it's not a tiered threat level system, it's an immediate action trigger. When North Korea launched a missile over Hokkaido in 2022, J-Alert went out and people were told to take cover. The message was specific and time-bound.
The trust level in J-Alert is relatively high because it's not a constant background hum. It fires when there's something specific to do.
Taiwan has an interesting system because it's arguably the closest parallel to Israel in terms of facing a proximate existential military threat. Taiwan uses an air raid warning system that's integrated with their civil defense infrastructure, and they've been expanding their public alert capabilities significantly in response to Chinese pressure.
Do they have a tiered alert level, or is it also event-driven?
It's primarily event-driven, sirens and mobile alerts for specific incidents. But they've also developed a civil defense app that includes shelter locations, emergency supply information, and a digital ID for accessing services during a crisis. It's a hybrid model, some persistent readiness infrastructure, some acute alert capability.
Across all these examples, I'm seeing two fundamentally different philosophies. One is the thermostat model. You set a threat level and adjust it up and down as conditions change. The other is the smoke alarm model. It's silent until it's not. And when it goes off, you act.
That's a really useful framing. The thermostat model is the US color system, the UK JTAC levels, the French Vigipirate. The smoke alarm model is Israel's rocket warning system, Japan's J-Alert, the air raid sirens in Taiwan and Ukraine.
The thermostat model keeps failing in ways the smoke alarm model doesn't.
I think there are two reasons. One is that the thermostat requires continuous calibration, and threat intelligence is inherently uncertain and political. You're asking an intelligence agency to make a judgment call that will be publicly visible and politically scrutinized, and the incentive is always to err on the side of raising the level rather than lowering it, because nobody wants to be the person who downgraded the alert 2 days before an attack.
The classic bureaucrat's dilemma. The downside of being wrong in one direction is catastrophic, while the downside of being wrong in the other is just background grumbling.
And the second reason is that a tiered system implicitly promises granularity it can't deliver. What's the practical difference between yellow and orange, between substantial and severe? The distinctions are meaningful to security professionals making resource allocation decisions, but to a civilian trying to decide whether to take the train or work from home, they're almost meaningless.
The smoke alarm doesn't pretend to have granularity. It's on or off, and when it's on, you know what to do.
The smoke alarm has its own limitation, which is that it only works for threats with a specific detectable onset. A missile launch. You can detect that and trigger a warning. A terrorist plot that might culminate in an attack at an unknown time and place. You can't smoke alarm that. You need some kind of persistent awareness.
Which brings us back to the Israeli situation, where you've got both types of threats simultaneously. The rocket attacks have a clear onset, the siren, the 90-second window, the shelter. But the broader strategic threat from Iran doesn't have a siren. It's a deteriorating diplomatic and military situation that could escalate in ways that are hard to predict and harder to warn about.
That's where the absence of a formal tiered system for the broader threat becomes a real gap. Civilians are left reading tea leaves, canceled flights, troop movements reported on social media, statements from foreign governments. The information environment becomes the alert system, and it's not designed for that purpose.
What would a well-designed system for that kind of threat even look like?
I think you'd want something that borrows from the NTIS model. Specific, time-limited alerts with concrete guidance, but adapted for a threat that evolves over weeks and months rather than days. You'd want levels that map to observable changes in behavior, not abstract threat assessments. Something like normal operations, enhanced readiness, restricted movement, shelter in place.
Each tied to a specific set of instructions.
Enhanced readiness means check your go bag, confirm your shelter is accessible, make sure you have a family communication plan, stock up on essentials. Restricted movement means avoid large gatherings, work from home if possible, limit non-essential travel. Shelter in place means stay home, seal the room, wait for further instructions.
The key design principle would be that you only move up a level when the corresponding instructions actually make sense. If you're not asking people to do anything differently, don't change the level.
That's the discipline that most of these systems lack. They changed the level because the intelligence picture changed, without asking whether the civilian behavior should change. And if the behavior shouldn't change, the level shouldn't change. The level is for the civilians, not for the intelligence community.
There's also a communication infrastructure question. How do you actually reach people? The Swedish booklet approach is interesting because it's offline and universally distributed, but it's not real-time. The phone alert systems are real-time, but they depend on cellular networks that might be congested or compromised.
Israel has invested heavily in this. The Homefront Command app, the sirens, the cell broadcast system that pushes alerts to every phone in a targeted area. But you're right that these are all vulnerable in different ways. Cell broadcast is probably the most robust because it doesn't depend on data networks or app installations. It's a radio signal that every phone in range picks up, similar to how emergency alerts work in the US.
It's geographically targeted, which matters. A nationwide alert for a localized threat is just noise for 90% of the recipients.
The geographic targeting is something the US system has improved on significantly. Early iterations of the wireless emergency alert system would blast a tornado warning to an entire state. Now they can target down to the county level, sometimes even more granular. That matters enormously for trust. If every alert you get is relevant to where you actually are, you're more likely to take the next one seriously.
We've covered the US, UK, France, Sweden, Japan, Taiwan, Israel. Is there a model that actually gets this right?
I don't think anyone has fully solved it. But I think the NTAS model plus the Swedish preparedness baseline plus the Israeli event-driven response system gets you close. You need three layers. Layer one is baseline preparedness. Every household knows what to do in a range of scenarios, has supplies, has a plan. That's the Swedish booklet. Layer two is persistent situational awareness for slow-moving threats communicated through time-limited specific alerts. That's NTAS. Layer three is the smoke alarm for acute threats. The sirens, the cell broadcast, the immediate action triggers.
The discipline is keeping those layers separate and not letting one bleed into the others. Don't use the siren system to communicate a general elevation and tension. Don't use the threat level system to warn about an incoming rocket.
Category confusion is what kills these systems. When people don't know what the signal means, they either ignore it or panic, and both are failures.
The other thing that strikes me is that all of these systems assume a level of trust in institutions that may not exist. If the public doesn't trust the government, no alert system design can compensate for that.
That's the substrate everything else depends on. And trust is built or destroyed by how the system is used, not how it's designed. If you issue an alert and nothing happens, you lose trust. If you don't issue an alert and something does happen, you lose trust. If the alerts are perceived as political, you lose trust. The design constraints are almost secondary to the operational integrity.
Which is why the Israeli system is so interesting as a case study. The acute warning system, the sirens, the Iron Dome, has high trust because it demonstrably works. People see the interceptions, they know the system is real. But the broader strategic communication from the government is much less trusted because it's perceived as political, contradictory, and often disconnected from what people can observe themselves.
That's not unique to Israel. In the US, the color system lost trust because it seemed to spike around elections and major political events. The UK JTAC levels have been criticized for being opaque. The public is told the level changed but not why, which breeds suspicion.
The design principle is, be specific, be honest about uncertainty, tie every alert to concrete actions, and don't cry wolf, which sounds obvious, but apparently it's very hard to actually do.
It's hard because the institutional incentives push in the opposite direction. Being specific risks revealing sources and methods. Being honest about uncertainty sounds weak. Tying alerts to actions requires interagency coordination. And not crying wolf means accepting that sometimes you'll be caught flat-footed.
The public's expectations are part of the problem. People want to be warned, but they also want to be told everything is fine. They want specificity, but they also want simplicity. They want to be protected, but they don't want to be inconvenienced.
The fundamental tension is that a threat alert system is asking people to hold two contradictory ideas in their head at once. The situation is dangerous enough to warrant changing your behavior, but not so dangerous that normal life should stop. That's a psychologically difficult balance to maintain, and most systems don't even try to help people navigate it.
The prompt mentions something about this, the drive for normal life to go on, and how it's precisely in those moments of detachment that you end up unprepared. That's not a system failure exactly, it's a human cognition failure. We're not built to maintain low-level vigilance indefinitely.
Vigilance fatigue is a well-documented phenomenon in security contexts. Airport screeners, radiologists, cybersecurity analysts, anyone whose job involves sustained attention to rare events, they all show significant performance degradation over time. Expecting an entire civilian population to maintain that kind of vigilance without degradation is unrealistic.
Maybe the question isn't, how do we design a perfect alert system, but how do we design a system that works with human attention rather than against it?
And I think the answer is to minimize the cognitive load. Don't ask people to maintain a constant state of alertness. Ask them to do a small number of concrete things at specific, well-defined times. The Swedish model of preloaded preparedness plus occasional specific alerts is probably the closest to this ideal.
The go bag isn't something you think about every day. It's something you check once, and then it's there when you need it. That's the right model.
The alert system should work the same way. It's not a mood you maintain, it's a switch that flips rarely, and when it flips, you know exactly what to do because you already did the thinking.
To bring this back to the prompt's context, if you're living in a place where the threat is real and recurrent, and the government communication is inconsistent, what do you do? You build your own baseline. You maintain the go bag, you know the shelter locations, you have the family plan, and you treat the official alerts as one signal among many, not as the sole source of truth.
Which is essentially what Israelis have been doing for decades. It's a distributed, decentralized preparedness culture that exists partly because the formal systems are incomplete. That's both a strength and an indictment.
It's a strength in that it's resilient. It doesn't depend on any single authority or communication channel. It's an indictment in that the state should be doing better.
I think that's the conclusion the comparative analysis points toward. The best systems are the ones that combine clear, infrequent, action-tied alerts with a deep baseline of public preparedness. The worst are the ones that try to use the alert system as a substitute for that baseline, constantly tweaking the threat level because they haven't invested in making the population ready in the first place.
The alert system is the last mile. The preparedness is the infrastructure. You can't fix a last mile problem if the infrastructure isn't there.
Most of the political attention goes to the last mile because it's visible. The press conference where the threat level changes makes the news. The booklet mailed to every household doesn't. But the booklet probably does more to actually protect people.
Of course there are. The sizzle over the steak. What's the one thing you'd want someone to take away from all of this? If you're a civilian in a country that faces real threats, and you're trying to navigate the information environment,
I'd say, build your own baseline. Don't wait for the government to tell you what to do. Know your local risks, have supplies, have a plan, know your neighbors. The alert system, whatever form it takes, is a supplement to that, not a replacement. And when you evaluate whether your government system is working, ask one question. Does this alert change what I should actually do? If the answer is no, the alert is noise.
That's the test, isn't it? Everything else is theater.
There's a lot of theater.
And now, Hubert's daily fun fact.
In the 1910s, a now-abandoned theory held that medieval Hanseatic League trade regulations in the Faroe Islands prohibited the sale of dried cod on Tuesdays, which scholars of the era believed was evidence of an early Nordic sumptuary law system. The theory collapsed in the 1920s when a Danish archivist demonstrated the supposed regulation was actually a misreading of a storage inventory.
A misread inventory launched a decade of cod-based jurisprudence.
The Hanseatic League really did have an outsized influence on early 20th century academic imagination.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find past episodes at My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this one, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.